Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Hassan with another episode of the Influence Continuum. And this is a very special interview, I think, very unique, because I have a Unitarian Universalist minister on who has actually been excommunicated from the world's most liberal religion. And I want to introduce him, Reverend Dr. Todd F. Eckloff, who is a native of San Francisco, California, where he was born, has been a minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Spokane, Washington, since 2011, where he's appreciated for his mind-altering sermons, compassionate soul, and social activism. He's been widely appreciated for his environmental and gay rights activism. In addition to engaging in areas of criminal justice reform, restorative justice, the peace movement, as well as immigration and racial justice. So he has written The Gadfly Papers, Three Inconvenient Essays by One Pesky Minister, which is fascinating, and then a Gadfly Affair, a 21st Century Heretic's Excommunication from America's Most Liberal Religion. And may I call you Todd, Reverend Doctor?
Please do.
So I just want to say a little bit more about your history and your background, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You started in the ministry as an ordained Southern Baptist minister, but left while in seminary as a young man, explaining, "I simply outgrew it." Then you went into a 16-year career in TV news and corporate video production, during which time you became a Unitarian Universalist in 1988 and re-entered the ministry in 1999, where you began serving the Clifton Unitarian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, until 2011. So you have two undergraduate degrees, one in philosophy, another in communications, a master's of art in religious studies, and a doctor of ministry. You're also a member of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association. I can go on and on, but I think my listeners have the gist. And I want to hear more about your journey and how you came to call yourself a gadfly and how you came to be excommunicated. So share with our listeners some more details in this fascinating story of yours.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been an honor, really, to get to know you. Both of your books, well, you've done more than two books, but particularly your book on mind control and The Cult of Trump have been very helpful to help me understand and reframe what's going on in my religion, Unitarian Universalism. So I appreciate that. And I've been sharing your ideas with others, other Unitarians who are concerned, as well as members in my church. So I've been quoting you quite a bit lately. So you
made a real difference. Understand you were excommunicated, but you're still a minister of your local church. So just for my listeners, explain how that works.
Yes. So Unitarianism and Unitarian Universalism has traditionally been a very liberal religion, almost defined by its commitment to individual dignity and therefore freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of expression. That's kind of going away. With that, we have autonomous congregations, what we call congregational polity, that are free from any sort of denominational influence or control. And we value above all else the freedom of the pulpit, where ministers can speak for themselves. So to come under attack as a minister by the Unitarian Universalist Association was in and of itself strange. So I was really excommunicated, or in their term, it's disfellowshipped from the official order of ministers, if you will. So I lost the UUA credentials. They don't consider me a minister. Their website, which they created a page for outcast ministers just for me, is called, I'm called an ethically unfit for ministry is it abusive bully? No, an uncooperative bully is my crime. So I'm no longer allowed to go to professional meetings. I'm not part of the UU Ministers Association. I've been excommunicated, if you will, from the official order of UU ministers. But so long as a congregation wants to, a congregation can really have anyone they want as a minister. Mm-hmm. They have been going through the UUA's process. That's changing now because more and more people are becoming aware of what's been happening. So that's sort of the long answer, that we're a free religion and the church is free to keep me as long as they want.
Yeah, but I want to tell my listeners, we've talked previously and you really impressed me with your level-headedness and your philosophical depth and your commitment to dialogue and perspectives. And so that's a reason I really wanted to have you on. And I even sent you my bite model to ask you to look at it and see if it would fit at all in terms of what how the church has changed in the last few years. And you said, actually, it was eye-opening for you to review that.
Incredibly eye-opening. First, it really forced me to get the anecdotes right, where I could sort of look at the examples of what's been going on and put together a really long format, ended up about 8 pages. And then I went back from that and really worked your model. And there's really, you know, something in every one of the bite categories. Perhaps the least amount are under behavioral control, because for now we still remain autonomous congregations. They're trying to change that. I'm not going to go into that, but they are trying to change that. And the biggest infiltration was really getting control of ministerial training, ministerial credentialing, and then filling the pulpits through their process so that only their ministers are making it into the congregations. Hmm. And that's where some of the behavioral control is seeping in. So I actually talked a lot about the financial exploitation, manipulation, and dependence, because you can't get into the ministry and be accepted in the ministry through the traditional means unless you swallow the Kool-Aid, so to speak. And that means that these ministers are worried about losing their jobs, losing their careers, and throwing away years and lots of money on the education they received.
So kind of a top-down pyramid control of some of the uppity-ups. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I wouldn't call them uppity-ups. The folks are certainly leading the organization at this point. I think they're idealists. They have an ideal that I would disagree with, and I have disagreed with it. Mm-hmm. My problem is not the fact that we have different ideas. The problem is that I said I disagree. I'm having some concerns here, and I was immediately attacked by hundreds of ministers within 24 hours of giving away my book, called racist, homophobic, transphobic, ableist, and classist in 2 public letters that went out. I managed to give away 200 books before I was banned from the meeting in which I was giving it away, a meeting of Unitarian Universalists right here in Spokane. And over 350 ministers signed these letters within 24 hours. There was one preamble that went out to one of the letters saying, please don't read this book. Trust those of us who have seen it, not read it, because they couldn't have had a chance to read. So there's this real panicked, knee-jerk reaction to somebody disagreeing with them.
Yeah, that definitely strikes the box for information control, because as you know, I think if something is legitimate, it will stand up to scrutiny and people need to make up their own minds. So if there's someone who's raising alarm bells about things that are shifting, and then they're telling people, sign a letter, you know, distancing yourself from this person and don't read this book and make up your own mind. Man, that's a 5-alarm fire from my point of view.
Yeah. And, you know, the attempt to go after a person's character and career and livelihood by you know, these horrible modern assaults. You know, I mean, I still haven't recovered from being called these things. There are people that I've known for years that can't speak to me. People in the, you know, community figures here in Spokane that I used to work well with that I don't hear from anymore, not because they really think I'm a racist, homophobic, transphobic, ableist, classist. But
what does that even mean? What is a ableist? What does that, all those things mean? I know I get called, you know, transphobic most recently, but I'm not. And
right.
But what are these other words that are being cast?
Yes. Well, I think that somebody went through my book, flipped through it, and found different subjects I'd spoken about and just said, oh, he's speaking about racism here. Let's call him a racist. He's speaking about, you know, so they really don't make much sense. A couple of them, the transphobia is really if you, were aggressively wanting to prohibit people from representing themselves as they want to, you might be called transphobic. I wouldn't call it phobic. I think it's more of an anger or a rage or a prejudice. But nevertheless, somebody who questions what is going on about, you know, well, I have serious questions about saying that there's no such thing as gender reality, that male and female are only cultural inventions. That doesn't make sense. I have questions about how we should be responding to young people who are going through this with dramatic medical interference. And they call it gender affirming care. And you hear news stories saying, these different states are denying gender affirming care. Well, that's very euphemistic. And I think it's irresponsible of the media not to say what specifically those bills are trying to prevent. Mm-hmm. And if that is puberty blockers, they should say that rather than gender affirming care. I'm a liberal. I want people to be comfortable in their own skin. And if they want to, whatever they want to wear and however they want to feel, that's great. But if we don't ask questions, then we're transphobic. See, really, they're trying to make us transphobic by this issue.
They're labeling us because I, too, have real concerns about medicalization of minors without long-term studies. I know about Lupron as a puberty blocker, and it's not FDA approved for use to block puberty, period. There's no longitudinal studies that it's safe for young people. And there are endocrinologists who also question the use of cross-sex hormones for underage people as well, because so many people grow out of gender dysphoria. And I'm hearing very little about social media's effect on making people more vulnerable and susceptible to the notion that they were born in the wrong body. And Jonathan Haidt recently has a book, Anxiety Generation, where it's internationally proven that their young people are depressed and anxious and they're having eating disorders and body dysmorphia and all kinds of other things by being online too much and the contagion effects that seem to be prevalent. So forgive me for going on, but I'm agreeing.
No, I think you're right on. And this is the problem. The fact that you and I have said even what we've said so far, people will come down on us and call us transphobic. By the way, we're transcurious officially because we're asking questions, right? So we're transcurious, not transphobic. But the reality is that people will attack us. And that's where, to me, the cultish and certainly illiberal behavior comes in. When you go after somebody for saying something you're unwilling to talk about, unwilling to let your ideas stand up to scrutiny and conversation from people who really want to be open and who are genuinely caring about the welfare of everyone. And we want people to be free and to present themselves. I mean, I agree. I think there's an awful lot of cultural overlay that determines what we perceive to be male and female roles in our society. But we can't, but there are also real realities. There's real behaviors. I mean, I have a lot of turkeys in the neighborhood here. This time of year, you see the males.
We do too, actually, here in Boston.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean. I mean, these animals display very different behaviors as male and females, particularly this time of year. That's not a cultural, you know, they've not been culturally pressured to do that. This is so t- to not be able to have the conversation. Well, what is male behavior? What is human male behavior? What is human female behavior? Typically, not morally. I'm not talking about what we have to, how we have to force people to behave. There's always anomalies, but what makes us behaviorally male? What makes us behaviorally female? How has that evolved and changed over the years? And what is the cultural BS that's put upon us? But we can't talk about it because as soon as you do, you're called transphobic. And that's just one example.
Yeah, but I'm gay friendly, and I believe you are too. My son's gay, and from the age of 3, he liked to take his pants and put it on his hair and wear high heels. My wife and I were like, oh, that's okay, you know, and we were fine with it. And my temple is very, you know, pro-gay and pro-trans. And I don't have a problem with adults who want to be trans as long as they get therapy and they understand that there are consequences of messing around with biology that could be really horrifying. And I was asked to talk with a man who had transitioned for 20 years to be a woman. He was 19. And he was becoming a psychologist, and he said, "I realized I had gender dysphoria, and I've been taking estrogen, and I took off my organs, and I regret it. I have a girlfriend, and I want my organs back." And he wanted to share his experience at WPATH meeting, and they wouldn't allow him to share a perspective. And when I first heard that, I was like, that's cultic. That's somebody's an ex-member, and therefore what they want to say and what their experiences doesn't matter. Yikes.
Yeah, there's a real sense of betrayal. I've watched some of the testimonies of folks who have what they call detrans.
Yep, detransitioners. Detransitioners.
Desisters. And they get the same thing. They get just turned on immediately as having betrayed the faith, if you will, and that's where it makes it scary. And I think this attitude applies to a lot more than the issue around transgenderism, and gender dysphoria and all of that, you know, that's related to it. You almost can't say anything someone disagrees with anymore. On either side of the aisle, you and I watched this happen in the news media. Started with when Ronald Reagan ended up getting rid of the, some of the communications restrictions and got rid of the fairness doctrine, and that Rush Limbaugh was the first one who really was born out of it. Unfortunately, Clinton made it worse. You know, he even deregulated more. I was in the news industry at the time, and I remember when these big corporations just came in and gobbled up all of these entities in these small communities. And suddenly we were about making money for some shareholder somewhere who had nothing to do with the news business, and the pressure to hype it up and all of that, you know, was sort of what news became. You had Rush Limbaugh, you ended up with Fox News, you ended up with MSNBC, which in my opinion is no better, nor is CNN. Just a lot of bias presented, a lot of speculation that goes for news. And this is what generations have now grown up in, and information that is at war, instead of telling us what happened today or what is going to happen tomorrow or what is scheduled to happen in the future. They go after the people they disagree with.
The internet is zeros and ones, and things are very simplified. All the nuances of real life get simplified. But as you know, I think from my book, The Cult of Trump, I've been talking about fourth generation and fifth generation psychological warfare by Russia, China. Michael Flynn was doing it to other countries. Now he's doing it on Americans. And it seems to me a very systematic infiltration of both the, used to be called the left and the right, to make them more extreme in order to create more chaos and uncertainty for all the people in the middle going, what? And a lot of the deleterious effects include self-censorship because you don't want to be canceled. And, you know, cancel culture is on the right and the left. I mean, Trump canceled Colin Kaepernick for his display and ended his career and Dr. Seuss books and other things. But it's been something that's been directed more at the progressive left. And I'm like, we're on one planet together. Can't we all like get along and listen to each other and agree to disagree, but think about the public good? And I think you share that perspective, you know, do no harm, and let's find ways to talk.
Yeah, it's the only thing that has ever enabled humanity to progress and to progress. And I mean that. I mean, that's a very black and white statement. I don't usually use things that kind of extreme language, but my study of history, this is the only means that humanity has ever really progressed. And that dates back to the pre-Socratic philosophers 2,600 years ago, who were the first that we know of to really try to explain the world in natural rather than supernatural terms. Aristotle called them the physikoi, the physicists. And they try to figure out all these, what's the world made of? And they came up with musical octaves. They came up with surgery. They came up with mathematics, the Protagorean theorem, and just all these really weather forecasting. I mean, it was remarkable what they discovered. And all that ends up getting shut down about the time of the Christianization of Greek society. And we went through about 1,000 years of no progress because we were forced to have one idea.
One truth.
And people thought if we have one idea, we'll all get along. We can't allow different ideas because we would be at war. And so we'll go at war to keep the one idea, right? And it was just this terrible dark ages. I mean, think about how much we've advanced in just a couple of hundred years. I think about the waste of human potential back then. But things got so bad, particularly with the invention of the printing press, which we're having another printing press moment today.
Yeah,
the democratization of information. And suddenly people started getting new ideas, different ideas. And to put the genie back in the box, we ended up with 100 years of some of the most violent, despicable human behavior. Over 1 million people were killed, tormented, tortured, declared heretics, all that kind of stuff. And finally, the Renaissance comes along and they say, you know, there has to be a better way. And what the Renaissance refers to is the renewal or renewed interest in the pre-Socratic philosophers. And then there was this period of exploring tolerance. In fact, my religion, the Unitarians in Eastern Europe, where they became formalized in the 16th century, came up with the first religious toleration law in history in 1568.
Wow.
Prior to that, toleration was seen as an evil. People who even spoke the word were considered dangerous. So for a king to say, I'm a Unitarian, and we're going to let everybody have their own religion here, and nobody gets to be persecuted or arrested or anything for it, was remarkable. That led, of course, to the Enlightenment, which was a widespread. These ideas were widespread, and democracies were formed and that sort of thing. They really became popular, which led to the 1800s, which was one of the most inventive. In fact, it is the most, even to this day, despite all the computer technology we have, the most inventive period in human history. But each time, there's a backlash to reason, right? Each time there was this sort of backlash to logic and reason. The pre-Socratics were declared pagans and heathens. Most of the works of antiquity, 90%, were destroyed during the Renaissance. There was again a rejection of actual logic and reason, particularly in response to the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Romanticism came along, postmodernism, which is what's happening today. Really, the Enlightenment died in the 1950s when the universities here in the States became attracted to the German philosophers, who were attracted to the French philosophers, who were postmodernist. And that really became this truth is subjective. You know, there is no truth and everybody's feelings are what matter the most. But it's always a rejection of, I mean, I'll even ask you about this because you're a psychologist, but this wish not to deal with the external reality, to not cope with the external reality and to criticize those who do as somehow being small-minded, enemies, dangerous, whatever it is. And they always go after the intellectuals and reason and logic. I'll say one more thing, then I'll be quiet. The only real criticism about my book that anyone has actually documented something I said in my book is my use of logic. They don't even criticize my logic, just the fact that I use it, which has been called, a cornerstone of white supremacy culture. Use logic and reason. So this was another attack against the use of reason. What do you make of this?
So all I can say is that going back to Reagan taking away the standards in communication, that there needed to be a public good, and privatizing that, and Rush Limbaugh, as you mentioned, I don't know if you've seen a documentary, The Brainwashing of My Dad, or the book by Jen Cinco, but she talked about her father, who was a regular guy, got a job and started driving long distance and started listening to Rush Limbaugh, and then graduated to Fox News, and he became extreme and racist, and everything was immigrants are killing, you know, destroying the country and other things. And it was a fascinating documentary because Jen went and interviewed Republican strategists, including Frank Luntz, who wrote Words That Work, and other people. And in the end, her father got returned back to himself because the TV broke and they turned it off. And I reflected as I read, saw the documentary, read the book, and I've interviewed Jen, that what helped me get out of the Moonies was having that van crash, being in the hospital away from the group, and the constant reinforcement of the ideology and the cultic programming that allowed me to start reflecting. And I missed my sister, who I was very close with, which led to my deprogramming. And so I wound up, Todd, doing a TEDx talk, How Can I Know If I've Been Brainwashed? And I outlined a four-step reality testing strategy, which step one is, guess what? Turn off the phone, turn off the media, like sleep, eat, walk in nature, read poetry, listen to music that you love, and reflect back on like who you were before all of these changes. Study the BITE model and Chinese communist brainwashing models of Robert Lifton, and then seek out critics and former members. Because if you want to know if you've been brainwashed, you have to listen to the people who've been quieted or where you've been told under information control, the BITE model, that you can't read that apostate literature. You can't talk to that cult expert. You can't read that book. You'll be in sin if you read Combating Cult Mind Control. I say you're an intelligent person. Listen for yourself and decide if there's merit to what they have to say. Then reflect back on your experience, reviewing the BITE model, going back in time to your first entrance into this new belief system or political party or whatever, and then decide whether or not, if you knew then what you know now, whether you would have said yes to that first rally or that first, you know, documentary, et cetera. And if the answer is that you wouldn't have joined, then you know it's time to leave. And it's a simple strategy that anyone can do for themselves to reality test. But you have to have a certain confidence in your intelligence, and you have to have a certain grounding to say, yeah, I want to track down the loudest, most credentialed critic. And that's another piece about fourth generation warfare. They want to attack experts. They want to attack science. They want to attack democracy and democratic institutions to set us up for fascism or, you know, totalitarianism. And so my answer is, let's talk. Let's have a range of ideas from many perspectives, mm-hmm. but let's remember, if we value our freedom, we need to create the space to understand this diversity, and different people have different opinions. And instead of being all or nothing, black and white, good versus evil, which is under the T of the BITE model, we have complexity and nuance. So
yeah,
that's a bit of what I have to say.
And so much I, what you said, I read in your books too, and really found it hopeful, you know, that this, I won't call it easy, but certainly easier than I would have imagined. You know, as you point out in your book on mind control, it's deprogramming isn't about kidnapping someone, throwing them in a van and taking them off to a cabin for the week. And it's just getting them away where they can think for themselves, right? Almost giving them a breath of fresh air. And I think that's really hopeful that if, you know, as you say, if we can just get people thinking for themselves, you know, the number one personality comes back to the front and is able to think for itself. And you have people that look back and say, what was I thinking? How could I have believed the aliens were coming to transport me onto their ship?
COVID was a hoax, or, you know, the Democrats are all killing and trafficking babies and draining their adrenochrome. Hello? Yeah. You know, knock, knock. Let's come back to sanity. But, you know, I became a radicalized person from college. I thought God wanted Nixon to be president despite Watergate, even though I hated Nixon and distrusted Nixon. My father voted for Nixon. And my story is, I was sent with the Moonies to fast for 3 days on the Capitol steps. And I thought my father would be proud of me and happy. And I told him, and he's like, Steve, you are right. He's a crook. You know, I'm like, Dad, you don't understand. God wants him to be president. He said, Steve, he's a crook. Now I know you're brainwashed. And I'm like, Dad, you're letting Satan control your mind. But it happened to me. So I've been saying for 47 years, this is not a phenomenon that happens to stupid, uneducated people with don't come from good families or have a religious training, because I had all of those things. I was situationally vulnerable, and I didn't believe anyone could ever brainwash me. And the Moonies used that to the hilt. And unfortunately, my parents and my best friends, they all try to argue me out of my beliefs. And the more they did that, the more I felt persecuted, and the more I felt like, you know, I had to get away from them because it confirmed my indoctrination. My mother, my dear mother, said, let's go talk to the rabbi. And I'm like, fine. This was in the very beginning. And I sat down with the rabbi, and I said, is it true that the Jews believe that a Moshiach is coming, a Messiah is coming? And he should have said, tell me more. Why are you asking me this question? I would have said, I went to this weekend workshop. It was 3 days. I didn't sleep. And they're saying that the Messiah is coming to Earth and he's a Korean. I would have told him that if he'd asked.
Yeah. Wow.
And what he should have said to me is, you know, Steve, if a group is legitimate, it will stand up to scrutiny. Promise me you won't go back to any more meetings until we figure out who are these people and what do they teach and what do they believe. But he didn't think of any of that. He thought I was wanting to convert to Christianity, which I had no interest in doing. But So anyway, I've been spending 47 years trying to tell people, don't attack the leader, the doctrine, or the policies of the group. Adopt a respectful, curious, asking questions approach. Take an attitude of, hey, maybe I'll join too. Convince me. Let's, you know, help walk me through this. And again, outlining, let's look at the models of brainwashing and let's see if there are any concerning, you know, attributes here. Like, what is their attitude to former members or critics? Because that's always a big red flag that there's information control and maybe some emotional manipulation, fear, and phobia indoctrination and such. But it's amazing to me. We just need to come back to sanity. We need to come back to love and that we're on one planet together and that our futures intertwine with other people. And otherwise, it's going to be the authoritarians and the people who are pushing fossil fuels that don't want government regulation or the big tech companies that don't want government regulation to interfere with their profits. You know, we need regulation of big corporations that are trying to take our freedoms away.
Yeah, and you know, you said something earlier about if we want freedom, and that really is the question. I remember reading Eric Fromm's book, Escape from Freedom, which pretty much argues that if we don't really want freedom, you know, freedom scares us because it means separating from the group mentality. And there's a lot of danger in that. There's feelings of isolation. There's feelings of loss of perhaps belonging, all of that side of that difficult angst that humans have between freedom and belonging. And if we can't cope with our fear of freedom, we become fascists. You know, this is Fromm trying to figure out the Holocaust, right? What the hell happened?
Yeah, I read that book after the Moonies. I didn't agree that we're trying to escape from freedom because I was running towards my freedom, having lost it, because I had a reference point for what it's like to lose your freedom. But I use Fromm, especially his malignant narcissism criteria, which is the stereotypical profile of all cult leaders and fascists, you know, the lack of empathy, the entitlement, the grandiosity, all of those, plus thinking they're above the law and the pathological lying and the threats and the sadism. And chapter 3, as you probably remember, the cult of Trump. I compare Trump with Jim Jones and my former cult leader, Sun Myung-moon, and Hubbard of Scientology. And if anything, people should understand Donald Trump is a lesson in what a profile of a cult leader is all about. But of course, I've gotten banned from the media. With one exception, I was on Joy Reid of MSNBC a few months ago, but I used to be on TV all the time. I was on Fox as well. I've had a few outliers. Megyn Kelly interviewed me. Joe Rogan interviewed me in 2015 before Trump came in. And he loved me and he said, come back again. And as soon as I got the cult of Trump came out, I said, hey, Joe, remember you invited me back? He said, pass, you know?
I'm glad you brought that up because that was something I really wanted to ask you. I mean, just the title alone, but the book itself, I said, man, this was a gutsy move. This was a gutsy book to write. What was going through your head when you wrote it? What trepidation? I know when I wrote mine, I had trepidation. Mine is a drop in a bucket compared to the reach you have and the reach your book has had, especially on the subject you've had. What was that process like that brought you to that place where you had the courage to write that book?
It really was. I really don't think of myself as a political person. And my book agent said, well, I want you to do this book. And I said, it's going to alienate half the country. I don't want to do that. He said, but they won't read the book anyway. You should educate people who want to understand your work. And this is an opportunity with Simon & Schuster to have a much bigger audience than you've ever had. And I knew Trump was a malignant narcissist. That's really all I knew when I agreed to the title. But as I started researching it, I realized there were authoritarian cults that comprised the cult of Trump, and that there were foreign actors like Russia who had been influencing Trump for a really long time. And so then I just had a moment of conscience of, it, would I live with myself turning down this opportunity if he is as bad as I think he is going to be? And so I bit the bullet and I did it. And I'm proud of the book because it stood the 5 years since it's come out. Everything's been validated. I even said if he didn't win in 2020, there would be violence. And I cited Jim Jones and what happened when Leo Ryan tried to help rescue people who wanted to leave the jungles of Guyana. So I'm proud of it. And honestly, the book was supposed to come out in August of 2019. And my publisher was like, everyone under the sun want to interview you, Steve. Every single major publication and TV show, they're off for the summer. So we're pushing back the publication date to October. And I was excited. And then October came and almost no one would interview me.
Wow.
And I was like, what's up here? And the publicist for Simon & Schuster said, well, I talked with one of my friends in TV, and she said, if Steve wants to talk about the Attorney General of the United States being an Opus Dei and calling it a cult and thinks he can get on TV, forget it. That was what the publicist said. Because I had helped people with Opus Dei, which is a right-wing secretive Catholic group that was a prelature of a previous pope who thinks the current pope is satanic, I might add, and is very critical of his liberal policies towards gays and climate change advocacy, etc. But you know, I would rather sleep at night knowing I'm doing the responsible thing, honoring my conscience, and hoping that people will take the risk and listen. And I'm hoping people will want to listen to you and question what's going on that, you know, the most liberal religious group is censoring one of their own. And you're so knowledgeable and literate and articulate. Why?
Well, I appreciate that, and I really appreciate your sentiments around your book too. I experienced the same thing. Now, for your audience, my book is a very niche market. Okay, it's self-published. I wrote it. By self-publishing it, I could print it the most affordably, and I could just hand it out. So, but it's also the best-selling book among Unitarians ever written. I continue after 5 years to sell a book or two a day. We're a very small religion, just, you know, maybe 800,000 of us in the country. But I had that same sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. The General Assembly was going to be held here in Spokane that year. I'd already been working on some writing about my concerns, and then The Coddling of the American Mind came out, and I read it, and I said, my gosh, this explains so much, that I started using that as an example of what was happening, because I have a chapter in it called The Coddling of the Unitarian Universalist Mind.
Mm-hmm.
But
Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt.
Jonathan
book.
Haidt, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be very helpful, but I also didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I didn't have a lot of time to do it. Secondly, I knew based on what I was writing about that there'd be some repercussions. I didn't know what they would be exactly. I thought mostly it'd be just destroying my character online. I didn't realize they'd actually come after me as a real person, not a virtual person, but a real person. And yet I said the same thing to myself. If I don't seize this opportunity, first of all, nobody else can do it. Just as nobody else could write the cult of Trump.
Right.
Right. And it has to be done in a timely fashion. If anybody's going to make the Unitarian world aware of what's going on, it's going to be this opportunity. So I felt like I had this moral duty, come what may, to write the book.
Yeah, and I appreciate you reaching out to me, because I was like, this is interesting. A Unitarian Universalist minister wants to talk to me. So we chatted, and I was like, wow, would you come on my podcast? I really think you have an important message to put out. If I may just comment about Lukianoff and Hate and Fire, which is advocating for free speech. And I have grave concerns about free speech is being used to divide us rather than responsible speech. And I reached out to Greg after I listened to The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, because I was very interested to hear that because of the trans controversy, et cetera. And I had already interviewed a number of detransitioners and heard their story about being basically raised in homophobic churches with no sex ed and them not being encouraged to be gay, but being encouraged to be trans, and as well as folks on the spectrum who are anyway have a different theory of mind than neurotypicals. And then I was hearing about hypnoporn. In any case, I wanted to hear this thing, and I reached out to Greg and I said, hey, how about, promoting the cult of Trump? You want to promote free speech? Have me on, zero. And I've done a number of interviews and podcasts about the Koch Corporation, the second largest private corporation in the United States that I believe is the major funder behind Fire in the free speech movement. But I'm convinced that because I interviewed Christopher Leonard, who wrote Cokeland, I'm convinced they want to keep pushing fossil fuels. And therefore, they're using, public distraction and disorientation to undermine any effort to put real regulation and to take away the subsidies, the $1 trillion subsidies of the oil industry. They're making record profits. I really want people to step back and understand there are very powerful state actors, corporation actors who have agendas that are really about Ayn Rand and selfishness is good and altruism is evil, or, let's do social Darwinism. If I have more money than you, that means I'm superior to you, which is like, what? But they actually believe they're entitled to be, to have extra rights because they have a corporation and made a lot of money. So I'm trying to do what I can to pull back the curtain and ask people, let's take our power back and let's not be part of the noise and the put downs of everyone else. And let's really think about policies that make sense for the majority of people, even if they're unpopular with very outspoken extreme positions, because these extreme positions are occupying so much of the media space and they shouldn't. Because we're the majority.
Yeah. And most people are kind, compassionate people who want to do the right thing and care about their neighbors and don't want anybody to suffer. That's not how we're being represented in the media either. I think it's really interesting to me, the point about Fire. I'm going to be attending the Heterodox Academies conference in Chicago in June. And that's something Jonathan Haidt started. And, of course, he's the Fire is represented there. But I'll ask him. I'll ask him what's going on. I don't know. I can't speak for them. But My sense is, one, because they are heterodox and not orthodox, right? And they're trying to be politically fair, which is a childish idea of morality. Mm-hmm. Fair is fair. Fair is fair, as little children say. That's not fair. That's not fair. Yeah. We understand that things are not all the same. In fact, right. That was my problem with Jonathan Haidt's original idea of the righteous mind. I thought that he took a three-dimensional three-dimensional idea of psychological and moral development and made it two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unintentionally. But I still think the world of him in many of his other writings, for sure. But I just wonder if the cult of Trump was, we don't want to offend our Republican friends or the other half. I don't know that to be true, but I'm curious about why he hasn't gotten back with you about this book.
Well, I also out like a cult that Jeffrey Charlotte wrote two books, and there's a Netflix series called The Family, which did the National Prayer Breakfast, and they recruited Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeffrey Charlotte named Obama and Clinton as being involved with this cult called The Family.
Yeah.
That when he wrote the book, he had never talked to a cult expert before, but I read the book and I'm like, Jeffrey, this is a cult. And not a good one. I recently heard Haidt on the Commonwealth Club talk with Tristan Harris. I did a Commonwealth talk myself with the cult of Trump, I'm happy to say. But he kind of said, I took the easy way out. I focused on children, the internet's effect on children's minds.
Mm-hmm.
I had interviewed a Harvard social psychiatrist, Carl Marcy, who wrote a Harvard University peer review volume called Rewired, where he took on all ages and the deleterious effects of being online so many hours with social media, just taking our data about all of our preferences with AI, and that's nudging our minds and manipulating us emotionally, largely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
section in your book on that, by the way. I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
In the cult of Trump. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is humans are either going to evolve or they're going to devolve, and I'm hoping that we will continue to evolve and we will continue to use the scientific method and we will continue to rely on trustworthy experts instead of saying, can't trust any experts, you can't trust any science, and democracy is second rate compared to an authoritarian government like the Chinese government or Russian government. And mm-hmm. I say, no, 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 no. Trust me. And, I'll just share that I was brought to Moscow when the Soviet Union fell by a group of psychiatrists and psychologists because Western cults were rushing into that country and they wanted to know about cults. So I'm teaching them about brainwashing and mind control. And they're sitting there going, Dr. Hassan, don't you understand? You're describing the whole system of pedagogy of the Soviet Union. We would put political dissonance into psychiatric facilities because they were criticizing the regime. Oh, now we understand. You are counseling us. And I said, if the shoe fits, And Putin was raised in authoritarian Soviet Union. That was the glory of Russia. And as a KGB official, his mission is to restore the glory of Russia, which is why he wants to invade Ukraine and take over Europe. And people don't understand. If you're born in an authoritarian political cult like the Soviet Union, you don't leave the mindset just by physically walking out. And I see this phenomenon in Israel. There are 1 million Russian emigres in Israel, and many of them are still listening to Putin propaganda, And they support Netanyahu in the same kind of all-or-nothing mentality against Palestinians. And the public doesn't understand that this is a mental health crisis. This is an epidemic of mind control viruses that circulating around the world. And we have the means now to name it and claim it, to use a ex-FBI trainer of undercover agents. He's like, if you understand the techniques being used on you, they lose their power. Once right. You can go, oh, behavior control, oh, emotional control, oh, information control. And that's why the BITE model has millions of hits now on the internet. It's circulating. And we're going to put up a BITE model analysis that you kindly filled out from your perspective.
Great.
And we'll welcome other people to comment on it as well on the YouTube and the podcast and such. Anything else you want to share about your journey and what you're hoping for in terms of anyone listening to this?
Yeah.
I think give a sermon, Doc.
Yeah.
Doc.
I'm really hoping that people will want to do exactly what you just said, and that is to think for themselves. Hmm. So often I find people who don't want to, right? We want to cling to our emotions, which express themselves as thoughts, and we hold those thoughts as sacrosanct. We moralize them, and then because we moralize them, our ideas are not only right, they're righteous. And we can go after others who are unrighteous for disagreeing with us. To be a person of integrity, though, with oneself, we have to think for ourselves. And what I would say is, you know, we're in another printing press moment, except it's on steroids. We have this social media, the internet. There are everybody has an opportunity to express themselves now, right? It's not information has been democratized,
right?
But it's as if we are all going into a room, a crowded room, and there's all sorts of conversations going on. It makes no sense. It's absolute chaos. We don't like chaos. So we do what you do in a room like that. You go find one conversation and you tune everything else out.
Hmm.
And the one conversation makes sense to us, makes the world make sense to us. It feels like we're the insiders and everyone else is the outsider.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things that we feel when we're not open to hearing from others is what we're doing right now to find sanity. And it's manifesting itself as cancel culture, which is identity politics, if you will, where people are breaking into groups based on their identity or being told they should, right? That's the sinister part of this ideology, is it's telling us we're too different to be safe together. We harm each other when we're together based on skin pigment, based on gender, based on sexuality, based on, God knows what. And they'll just keep fracturing. We'll just keep fracturing that way, and we'll become more and more divided. So we have to come to terms with becoming comfortable in a noisy room and moving around from one conversation to the next and becoming more broadly educated about different individuals, letting go of our identity. Nationality is another one. On the right, people tend to gravitate more towards the nationalism. Let's make America great again, as if we could somehow separate from our global community. How did Brexit work out, right? It doesn't work out. We can't isolate. We can't segregate. Those are the things that we have learned for years we've been trying to get away from.
Right.
And that's where, to me, the biggest solution for my sermon is tolerance. Mm-hmm. And tolerance doesn't mean you have to agree with others. It doesn't mean you have to like others. It doesn't mean you have to understand them. You don't have to go out and try to figure out what everybody believes and to make, you don't even have to listen to them. You just have to live and let live. That's when we advance. That's when we're at our best. If we can just say, yes, there's people who disagree with me, who think differently, who live differently, but we've got some common challenges before us, and we can come together and solve those. And I've worked with interfaith groups and political groups across the lines. And when we come at our common challenges,
right,
rather than our common difference, our differences, we accomplish great things.
Right. Wonderful. I want to put in a plug for Braver Angels, because they have been doing facilitated meetings of people, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, to foster, let's look at the common ground. Let's really listen to each other. Let's figure out what is a fair election. And they recently polled around the country and come up with criteria that both political parties and conservatives and liberals can agree on. I'm going to be interviewing them, because there's already claims that the election's going to be stolen, as it was back in 2016 and 2020, when all the facts indicate that it was a fair election, or at least there was no widespread election fraud.
Right.
So I want to thank you for reaching out, and I'm going to hold up both of your books again for those who are looking on the YouTube. The Gadfly Affair, 21st Century Heretics, Excommunication from America's Most Liberal Religion. Read it, especially if you are a UU person. And ask your leadership, hey, have you read it? Let's read it together, because I really want to hear what you think about the substance of the arguments in this. And let's have a conversation. So
thank you.
I thank you again, and let's stay in touch.
Most definitely. Really appreciate all you're doing, and it's such an honor to be with you today.
Yep, and we'll do a blog, and we'll add your bite model analysis to the blog and links to your book for our listeners. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That's it for today's episode of The Influence Continuum. I've been your host, Dr. Stephen Hassan. Theme music for the podcast is by Nasser Malik. To keep up to date with me and happenings that I think are important, please visit my website at freedomofmind.com. There you'll find in-depth articles about cults, mind control, and other relevant topics. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at @cultexpert. If you want to develop a comprehensive understanding of these topics, I highly recommend my books, Combating Cult Mind Control, Freedom of Mind, and The Cult of Trump, in that order. These books are a culmination of 45 plus years of experience, and will really help you grasp the complex web of undue influence. I have also launched a new 9-hour online course for anyone interested in a deep dive into issues related to recovering from undue influence in all forms. While this course is designed for clinicians, everyone can benefit. Remember, love is stronger than mind control. And thanks for listening.